Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, we'll hear from Carrie Brown, a professor of Chinese politics on China in the Trump era. And at the bottom of the hour, the Rome-based writer and researcher David Broder will analyze the Italian constitutional referendum that went down to defeat at the beginning of the month. First, Carrie Brown. During the presidential campaign, Donald Trump made a lot of hostile noises about China. Even the way he pronounced the name of the country exuded contempt. And he had a notorious phone conversation with the president of Taiwan, something that deeply displeased Beijing. Yet he just nominated Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, who has a friendship with the Chinese president Xi Jinping going back 30 years, and whose state exports a lot of agricultural products to that country. What does this all mean? Here's Carrie Brown, a professor of Chinese politics and director of the Lao Institute at King's College London, to help us figure it out. First, any comments on Trump's appointment of Terry Branstad as ambassador to China? For a guy who spent his whole campaign insulting China, to appoint someone who seems rather friendly with the country is a little bit of a surprise.
Well, I suppose it shows a more pragmatic side. So it seems this sort of former governor of Iowa, I think, is, and that's where Xi Jinping, the president of China, went in the mid-1980s, I think in 1985, and stayed for a few days. So apparently they are friendly with each other. So it's always good to have an ambassador in Beijing who has a link directly to the central leadership there. So from that point of view, it looks like it's a good choice. I suppose the thing is, how good is the link back into the United States? I mean, the ambassadorship from the U.S. to China is a political appointment, obviously. And the idea is usually that you've got someone who can talk to the top people in both places. So what's not super clear is whether that's the case this time. I mean, in the past, sometimes it's been true. There's been American ambassadors in Beijing, one of whom was George W. Bush's dormitory mate when he was at university. So they were friends with others that had a cooler relationship with the president. So, I mean, that's the really key thing, whether this person is able to get back to Washington and speak directly to Trump when he's president and say what's happening and what he needs to do when he gets listened to.
How did the Chinese receive the campaigning of Donald Trump? Were people in China shocked by his hostility? Did they just let it roll off? What was their reaction?
Well, it's been mixed. So, a lot of media commentary in China has been, this is a businessman, it's nice to have a businessman just shooting off like this, and, you know, kind of quite admiring in an odd way. But of course, his harshness on China, certainly in the economic area, is only now just really beginning to hit home. I think in Beijing they realize they've got someone who's quite unpredictable. No one really knows what he's going to do. But also on the Taiwan issue, as we saw over the early weekend in December, he is able to do things that surprise everyone, talking directly to the president of the Republic of China, and that's obviously a place that Beijing doesn't recognize. And not as the United States since 1979, so that was an extraordinary. And I think that really in this sort of area, Beijing will be watching him very, very closely. I think that they did assume, like most other people, that Hillary Clinton was going to win. They were quite surprised at the outcome. They have been pragmatic since then. Xi Jinping has had a telephone call with Trump, which apparently went quite well. But I think that they will be expecting the relationship to broadly continue as it has done, being practical for the outcomes, because for both sides, at the end of the day, there's too much to lose.
What about the Taiwan relationship? Is this supposed to be frozen in this non-recognition forever? Is there any way that that the U.S. and China and Taiwan could mutually recognize each other, or is that just completely out of the question?
No, I mean, for the Beijing regime, the People's Republic of China, this is a sort of, you know, an existential issue for them. It's the biggest red line, because they've always sort of predicated their legitimacy on national reunification, and this is the final issue. Hong Kong reverted to Chinese sovereignty in 1997, Macau in 1999, and so Taiwan is the great sort of colonial, in their view, holdover, and so if they were to compromise on this, they would feel like they'd lost all legitimacy to their own people. However, the one China policy that America has subscribed to, I think since the mid-1970s, has offered a pragmatic framework. I think Mr. Trump has really seen this as an opportunity to get the Chinese in an area where they are vulnerable, and it's the only thing really where they can be hurt, probably to try and get concessions elsewhere. And I mean, that's not a ridiculous, that's not a very ridiculous negotiating stance in some ways, but the problem really, of course, is it's awfully high risk. If there is misinterpretation of his actions and words, and if Beijing do feel that he is provoking Taiwanese moves to independence, there is actually in China a law, the 2005 anti-secession law, which commits the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, to going to war to make sure that independence doesn't happen. So this is no laughing matter. This is a pretty serious issue. And as Trump becomes president, this is the kind of thing where you don't want to kind of play sort of reality TV games.
God, well, I think we've got years of that ahead of us. Now, you said earlier that the Chinese had expected, like everyone else, including me, who wrote a book very critical of Hillary Clinton, that she was going to become president. But during, for her part, while Secretary of State and things she'd written and said, she was sort of interested in increasing military tensions with the Chinese. She's very concerned about the South China Sea. So there was she was fairly hawkish in her relation to China, not as explicitly hostile as Trump had been in the campaign. But what do you think about the general direction of U.S.-Chinese relationships? It seems like the U.S. is somewhat more concerned about China's international ambitions, and even Hillary Clinton wanted to do something about that. What's ahead for this?
Well, it's been categorized as a sort of frenemies relationship, neither friend nor enemy. If you look at the recent, every year there's this high-level strategic and economic dialogue between America and China, and the last one, if you look at the State Department website, it's 90 dialogues in areas from environment to scientific and technological exchanges, cyber espionage, cyber security. There's a big dialogue on that, of course. So you can't say that these partners don't talk with each other and they aren't highly aware of their importance to each other. And broadly, in terms of, if you look at the amount of trade between China and the U.S., I think it's about $6 billion U.S. dollars a year. China has something like $1.5 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries. When you own that much of someone else's debt, they do matter to you, because if they default, then you have a problem too. So it's really a complicated, difficult relationship, but one that both sides, the bottom line is they do know they've got to work with each other. Clinton did have this sort of very, very sort of consistent line right from the 1990s, actually. She visited Beijing in 1995 and went to the UN, I think, conference on women's issues. There she was critical of China on human rights, and she continued to be very critical. She was very instrumental in the rebalancing to Asia, and China felt this was containment. So they knew what they were dealing with her, but they knew that she would have been tough. With Trump, you've got a lot of uncertainty, and I think that will suit China in as much as it'll see spaces it can exploit and move into. It'll feel like this is a person that's going to be very transactional, that they can do deals with. But it won't suit China in as much as, obviously, Mr. Trump has already proved that he's very, very unpredictable. And that may make American policy towards China quite effective in some ways, because now China is the one that's exposed and pushed into a leadership position on climate change and free trade agreements. America is the one that's sort of provoking and acting like the kind of, in a sense, the sort of more junior partner. So it's a very strange moment. As I say, I think we'll have to sort of wait 6 months to a year before we see what things really happen. Usually, when new presidents come in America, China does expect some volatility, but it might be in for quite a roller coaster this time.
Now, about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Hillary Clinton came out against that during the campaign, but I don't think anybody took her seriously. It seemed like a campaign stance. And, of course, Trump wants to just junk the whole idea. But how do the Chinese see the TPP, and what will they make of its likely demise?
When it was first raised, this idea of a Trans-Pacific Partnership, China was pretty resistant. It wasn't part of the 11 nations. and it did interpret it as this containment, economic containment rather than security containment, but it felt that this was pointed at it and America trying to create a kind of economic zone around it where it was excluded. But then it became more sympathetic to the idea and was working with it. It proposed its own free trade agreement. The demise of this idea, or the likely demise of it under Trump, is good news for China because it means that its free trade area is going to go ahead almost certainly. But we're presented with this very paradoxical situation at the moment where you've got a communist one-party state as the biggest supporter of free trade deals in the world. And, you know, America, the great capitalist nation, not keen on them at all. So this is, I think, a sign of the kind of very complicated, almost counterintuitive sort of period that we're in. I think China's going to be very active on trying to sign free trade deals. It'll probably try and sign things like with the UK if it does eventually leave Brexit, leave the EU. It'll certainly go ahead very rigorously on this this Asia free trade zone. So I think this is an area where it definitely sees an opportunity with the Trump presidency.
What exactly does free trade mean in this context? It's not like tariffs are very high anywhere. So what do the contents of these free trade agreements look like?
I think for China, it's to actively offer access to its markets in areas where it needs help, like finances, services, technology, in return for a bit more market share for outside companies, and for it to be able to send more of its technological exports. I mean, Huawei, the telecoms company provider, for instance, into markets it feels at the moment are closed to it. And also in terms of investment, setting up investment protocols. So China is investing more and more, but it feels that there are sort of areas where it's not able to invest with a level playing field in countries, in resources and other areas. And it wants to kind of use these free trade agreements really to clear away those kind of impediments. So it's very, very tactical. With each country, it's slightly different. This will not be an easy thing for China to sign a free trade agreement across all the countries it's talking about. But I think the one thing it's got as an inducement is the potential for growth in its domestic market at the moment. You know, the Chinese domestic market is lower on services and consumption than most markets, and that's got to go up. And that's an opportunity for other countries outside of China to take part in that. So that's the reason why they've engaged with a free trade deal.
I'm speaking with Kerry Brown of King's College London. And on finance, they've been opening up somewhat to the outside world, letting the currency float a little bit, although they seem to have regrets every time they do it. But what about the financial relations with the outside world? Is China moving towards a more liberal financial regime, or are they going to try to keep it that movement as slow as possible?
It's a very protected sector in China, probably because they know it's not a particularly developed one, and therefore allowing too much foreign involvement will be overwhelming. They also know that they want to negotiate with partners coming in to get the best deal they can in areas where it suits them, but they don't want to open up China to sort of like a free-for-all where everyone's kind of taking money from it and making money hand over fist. So I think they're very, very cautious. With the Chinese currency, the renminbi, the Chinese yuan, they've got incremental sort of revaluation. They always feel that this is one of the great controls that they've still got, and they don't want to be too exposed to the vagaries of the outside world. Trump has said on day one that he's going to name them as a currency manipulator, but that is largely rhetorical. That's not really meaningful because you can name them as a currency manipulator and it doesn't change anything. The bottom line is that is it in America's interest for China to have a strong or a weak currency? Or is it in America's interest for America to have a strong or a weak dollar? And some people believe that America wants a weaker currency. Some believe that, you know, it suits Trump to have a weaker currency so that, you know, exports go up and all the rest of it. And for China to have a stronger currency would be pretty good too. So I imagine that's where the pressure will be. In the end, China's future growth is going to see much more finance and service sector development. And so there's got to be ways of foreign companies with their expertise and their managerial expertise and their knowledge being able to take part in this. So I think the battle for the next year or so is in what ways America and other companies can try and get a piece of this action, but also in what ways they can get better exports and better access to other sectors in the Chinese market. So without a free trade deal, America is still going to be doing the same kind of things that it would do if it was talking about a free trade deal with China.
A lot of Western pundits are always looking that the Chinese system, financial system, is going to blow up at any minute. That, you know, everything is very overleveraged. The banks are very questionable. A lot of murky stuff in the corporate sector. Is there anything serious to worry about, or are these just growing pains that China's going through?
It's always something to be concerned about. I mean, the property bubble in China has been a perennial problem, you know, forever. I mean, since the early 2000s. And many people believe if there's going to be a global recession that is pretty terrifying, it will be because of the Chinese property market collapsing. There's enormous problems of debt in China. No one really knows what the extent of the problem is. But you do have a lot of dynamism and space for growth in the Chinese economy. And so in a sense, the story over the last 40 years really has been that China's balanced this dynamism and growth, built an enormous amount of infrastructure, lots of investment into fixed assets. You know, it's really kind of built, you know, a sort of system where you can see future growth at least being sustainable for the next 10 to 15 years. And so I think, while we should never discount the possibility of a pretty nasty jolt in the Chinese economy, at the moment it looks like they have got most of the levers that they need to try and produce the right amount of growth and the right amount of job creation in order to make sure that there isn't, you know, areas like from property or debt that will jeopardize this. This is why the Chinese government are concerned about the state of the outside world and its predictability and, you know, the way in which its economy is performing. Very slow growth from the EU and better from the United States over the last 5 years are things that they've really had to factor in. The story really is that they've shifted from being reliant on export-led manufacturing growth much more to domestic growth. And so problems in domestic growth, particularly consumption, are the things that are going to most concern them, and inflation. So that's where all their policy is really sort of pointing at the moment.
Well, that's the story you hear, but are they succeeding in making that shift towards a more domestically oriented economy?
Up to a point. So services has increased definitely to something like, I think it's about 55% of overall economic activity. So that's gone up 10 percentage points just in the last 5 years. That's a big improvement. That's connected to urbanization. So urbanization levels have definitely gone up. It was 50% in 2010. It's probably already about 60% now. And the idea is it will be 70% in the next decade. So more people living in cities, which of course means more people in services and, you know, kind of those areas of the economy and finance. For consumption, though, that's the sort of problem. Consumption 5 years ago was something like 36% of GDP, and now it is 38%. So that has not gone up hugely. And so in a sense, the challenge for the Chinese government is still, how do you get Chinese people to save less and spend more? And that's connected with all sorts of other policy areas, which this government is trying to deal with at the moment. It's been trying to deal with since 2013, when there was a what we call a Communist Party annual plenum that had all of these promises to try and stimulate more growth and stimulate more, you know, rules-based sort of systems in the economy to make more predictability. And this is an ongoing story. It will only really culminate in 2021, when China wants to achieve what they call middle-income status country. And that means per capita GDP of about $13,000. That is a work in progress, and it's a rocky path there, which is why the politics in China at the moment is so brittle, because they do not have many spaces for making mistakes.
You know, you're looking at this record over the course of 30-plus years. It looks masterful from a distance. They engineered this enormous growth, greatest episode of economic growth in the history of the world. Rather skillfully, you know, certainly not perfectly, but it's been an impressive achievement in many ways. How firmly in control does the party remain? Is it as stable as it might look from the outside?
It is at the moment looking like it's got all the levers of control. I mean, one thing it's done is crushed any whisper of opposition. So there are no alternatives. The Communist Party politically is the only show in town. And under Xi Jinping since 2013, this anti-corruption struggle, there's been a big attempt to really ensure that there's no, you know, there's no dissent within the party elite. They've looked very hard at what happened to the Soviet Union in 1991, its collapse, and they have really, really, you know, made sure that they don't make the same mistakes in terms of putting politics before economics. They feel that they won't let the military get overmighty, and, you know, they're really kind of concentrated on building up the country materially. So the party at the moment is popular in as much as it's regarded as the only real option China has, and it's getting a nationalistic message across that, you know, for China to be a rich, strong, powerful country, the party is the one that's going to deliver that. No party, then there's no real likelihood of, you know, the country really achieving what it wants to achieve. Chinese people on the whole will sign up, I think, to a strong country. They want a strong, secure country that's respected and admired. If the price tag for that is having a one-party state at the moment, I think, you know, that's accepted. How sustainable this is, whether the one-party system is really sustainable into the medium to long-term future, that is not well really understood or known. There are plenty of challenges that could come and cause it problems, but at the moment it's looking pretty dominant.
And then finally, what about international ambitions? You know, China has been signing all kinds of agreements around the world, not just trade agreements, but, you know, to source commodities to feed its boom. It was very active in Africa, parts of Latin America, and also in its own neighborhood. Is it looking to create some kind of, I don't know, whatever euphemism for you want to use for imperial sphere, but is there some way in which China would like to become, you know, a major international power, especially if the U.S. starts receding?
I think it's very focused on getting the resources it needs for its economy, so oil from the Middle East, obviously, copper and iron ore from Australia and Latin America, and then some resources from Africa. It's pretty sort of self-interested in that way, but I think it doesn't want to overstretch itself. It's very wary of being lured into this sort of global role that it doesn't feel prepared for. It didn't want the G2, you know, talk of that a few years ago. It was resistant to that. And I think one of the challenges with the Trump presidency is, in some ways, China will be pushed into a position of leadership it doesn't really want. On climate change, it is now the leading country, in a sense, pushing for this because it has to. It's got huge environmental problems, and it accepts the science of climate change and human involvement. So it's definitely, you know, got no choice but to do what it said to Trump and, you know, say, stand by the Paris Convention. But in other areas, it will not want to take a leadership role. It will not be super happy if Trump, you know, kind of withdraws from the Iran or questions the Iran non-proliferation deal, the nuclear deal. It took a lot of effort in that and was a participant. And it does not want to have to step into the Middle East because it knows how treacherous the politics are there, despite the fact that it's got a lot of investments there. So I think this is going to be a game for the next few years of China trying to pick the things that it needs from the international community, but try and avoid being sucked into greater responsibility. I think it's just seen an acceleration of its moment of greater responsibility. I think in an odd way, Trump will give it some really, really interesting things it wants, more space in the region, possibly the idea of a deal on certain things, you know, particularly on Taiwan. I mean, they feel like they can maybe kind of talk in a different way because Trump may want to do a deal on these very big issues. But in other areas, they will definitely not want to be pushed into a position of exposure. The Middle East taking a role there, getting involved in any fights with Russia, getting involved in, you know, issues sort of beyond its region. China has very low appetite for this. So this is going to be quite a kind of, I think, quite a challenging time for China and everyone, but in particular for China.
I was Kerry Brown, a professor of Chinese politics and director of the Lao China Institute at King's College London. My name is Doug Henmore, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Thank you.
some of the Sonata in G, K-348, by Domenico Scarlatti, performed by Ralph Kirkpatrick, the man who gave his initial to the catalog of compositions by Scarlatti. Next, Italy. On Sunday, December 4th, Italian voters decisively defeated a referendum that would have modified the Italian constitution to increase the central government's power at the expense of the regions, and the executive's power within that government at the expense of the legislative branch. It was the latest in a series of electoral defeats of the neoliberal agenda, but does it fit into the right populist model of Brexit and Trump? Probably not, says our next guest, David Broder, a Rome-based writer and researcher who's been writing about Italian politics for Jacobin magazine. The referendum was proposed by Matteo Renzi, the leader of the Democrat Party, a center-left formation in the Clinton-Blair mold. Pundits in financial markets loved Renzi as a modernizer who would shake up the ossified Italian order. The only problem with that adoration was that it wasn't shared by most Italians, who rejected the referendum by close to a 60-40 margin. In accordance with his pre-referendum promise, Renzi resigned when the results came in. For more on what this all means, here's David Broder. So first, just let us know what that referendum was about, the one that Renzi lost.
Well, there was the question on the ballot paper, and then there was the real issues, you might say. Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, leader of the Democratic Party, had sought to resolve a long-standing debate on the Italian constitution and its electoral law after the last general election produced an indecisive result. At the start of this year, he promised that there'd be a referendum on the changes to the constitution, which mean effectively neutering the Senate and lessening the powers of Italy's regions, and giving the central government more power for the executive. This would also have meant whatever party came first in a general election, even with only, say, 30% of the vote, would have had an automatic parliamentary majority. But then what happened was that he promised to resign if he lost the referendum, saying that if he didn't succeed in changing the constitution, there'd be no way of getting through his economic reform package. Italy has extremely high youth unemployment, perhaps around 50% of under 30s, and has for over two decades had almost zero growth. So he has, in his premiership, sought a number of reforms to basically make it easier for employers to hire and fire workers and to make young people accept unpaid internships. The effect of his saying that he'd resign if he lost, as well as other events that have gone on with the European crisis more generally, really polarized the Italian population. And what you saw in the result was basically an alliance of all of the groups that wanted Renzi out of government for whatever reason, plus all of the movements who sought to preserve the constitution as it was. In Italy, there's a very close association of the left with the constitution, because the constitution was won by the anti-fascist resistance movements of World War II. While this event has been portrayed in foreign media as kind of part of the general rise of populisms or nationalisms in Europe, I think it's more complicated than that. There were lots of different movements opposed to Renzi's plan for opposite reasons.
Renzi's plan, am I oversimplifying perhaps, but it basically was a centralizing power grab to grease the rails for more neoliberal reforms, wasn't it?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. And not only was it kind of characterized that as that by the reform's opponents, including all of the major trade unions and the rest of the left, and indeed a quarter of Renzi's own party, but Renzi himself actively said that. His justification for saying he'd resign if he lost was he wouldn't be able to carry through his economic program. Of course, in reality, had the reform passed, then it would also have meant a strengthened executive, no matter what the government. Silvio Berlusconi, when he was in power, tried a very similar reform in 2006.
And let's talk about Renzi and this party. First of all, the Democratic Party is a relatively new actor in Italian politics. What's its history?
That's right. The Democrat Party, much of its membership comes from the old Communist Party. In the Cold War period, from 1947 till 1992, there were two parties that dominated Italian politics, the Communists and the Christian Democrats. People like to say that in Italy they've had 60 governments since World War II, but in fact every one of the governments from the 40s to the 90s was run by Christian Democrats designed to keep out the Communists. In 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Communist Party collapsed as well, and the lack of the Communist opposition undid all of the binds that held together the Christian Democrats. So none of the Italian political parties are more than 25 years old. The Democrats started out as a project to make the Communist Party into a social democratic party called Democrats of the Left, which had openly identified with Blair and Clinton and the Third Way. And over time, taking in some of the Christian democratic fragments of the past, some more liberal groups, it's become a party very much modelled on the US Democratic Party, also in the sense of losing its historic attachment to trade unions, local community groups, that kind of thing, and become a much more kind of top-heavy and media machine kind of party. And within the Democrats, Renzi is on the furthest right-wing extreme of that party. He first entered politics in the early 90s in a Christian Democratic group. And he, much like Tony Blair in Britain, who he sees as his mentor and even now explicitly identifies with him, despite Blair's unpopularity in Britain, so Renzi has a similar tactic of kind of deliberately attacking his own base, his own the working class support of the party, in order to try and marginalize the centre-right. Because Berlusconi's centre-right party, Forza Italia, has been much weakened by its continual scandals and the ejection of Berlusconi from office in 2011 by the European Union. So Renzi has kind of tried to muscle in on the ground of Berlusconi's party. In Italy, he's often called Renzosconi, the idea being that really he's a different face for the same policies. So over time, Renzi has made his party much more right-wing. In a sense, you could say it's similar to what Clinton tried to do in the US election by stealing the ground of so-called moderate Republicans. But what we saw in the referendum was a backlash by a solid part of the party and its electorate against what Renzi's trying to do. As I say, a quarter of Democratic Party voters voted no, and therefore to eject Renzi from office.
Now, the traditionally left-wing regions of Emilia-Romagna and Tuscany voted for the constitutional reform, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's very interesting, actually, because in general, the wealthiest parts of Italy voted for the reform, for Renzi. So there was actually also a disparity in the percentage of PD, of Democratic Party voters, who voted no. So in those regions, it was more like 20%, whereas in southern and poorer areas, it was up to 40%, like in Naples. It's a contradictory phenomenon. In a sense, it is the left of the party who voted no. And there is, as I said, an attachment, a kind of a very emotional attachment to the Constitution, which drove some of the no votes, you know, to keep it the same as it's always been. But part of the strangeness of the Democrat Party, as I say, because it was the old Communist Party and was never able to get in office, while the membership or the leaders kind of identified with Italy's republican institutions, they were never able to get into office for, you know, 50 years. So among certain layers of the party, there definitely is the sense that everything should be done to remain in power, that Renzi is a relatively popular leader, and that if he lost, they would risk going to early elections. Also, the far right is a stronger threat to the Democrats in the north, with the Northern League, than it is anywhere else in Italy. The Northern League is a separatist and hard right party. And recently in the local elections in May, it took over a lot of local authorities in the north. So in that sense, the referendum there was more polarized on Democrat versus Lega Nord grounds. I mean, I think another factor that also needs considering is the generational divide in the referendum, pensioners voted narrowly for yes. But the really striking fact is that 81% of under-35s voted for no. That also really speaks to economic problems, to massive unemployment. I don't think that the left is, or the historic left is necessarily strong among young people now, but we are seeing a kind of shift away from the old bastions of the left, perhaps.
Now, the centre-left, these neoliberal third-way types, have been fairly successful over the last couple of decades using the fear of Berlusconi as a way of selling their kinds of politics. Is that game over now?
Well, I mean, I think with Berlusconi specifically it is. He's very old. His party, Forza Italia, split. Berlusconi's only on about 11, 12% of the vote. And also, I think he would be unlikely to be able to lead a right-wing coalition as he has in the past. But I think what we are seeing is the same kind of phenomenon emerging, but with Beppe Grillo, the founder of the Five Star Movement, a very eclectic populist party, within the Blairite neoliberal centre-left imaginary, Grillo has sort of taken the place of Berlusconi as the figure they want to mobilise against and to galvanise their own supporters against. I don't think it actually worked in the Berlusconi case. What it probably did succeed in doing was destroying left opposition to the Democrats. It served as a pretext to demand the unity of the entire far left and centre left. So we even had things like the survival of the Communist Party, which was called Rifondazione Comunista. There was an occasion in 2006 where they basically voted for military credits for the war in Afghanistan in order to keep the centre-left in power and not let Berlusconi in. So there was a kind of strong pressure, don't let Berlusconi in. But really what that resulted in was that the far left just abandoned any kind of independent political position beyond anti-Berlusconi. And so in 2008 was the first time there was no communist MP since World War II. Now what we're seeing is that no one's accepting the same logic, the same argument in the kind of campaign to stop Grillo, and that in the referendum, the radical left certainly totally sided for no against Renzi, even despite the prospect that it might help Grillo and the Five Star Movement eventually come into government.
I'm speaking with David Broder, a Rome-based researcher, translator, and writer who has been covering Italian politics in Jacobin. Grillo, let's talk about him a bit. He is, what, a former comedian, right?
Yes, I think he would say that he's still a comedian.
Yes, I was going to say that too.
No, but it's very commonly repeated to say he's an ex-comedian by his detractors, including myself, because it's a snide way of saying that he's not very funny anymore.
So what does he stand for, and what does this movement stand for, if anything? Can one tell?
It's not easy to place on the political spectrum, or even to compare to other parties sort of in other countries. Because, you know, say, for example, in the European Parliament, parties are grouped internationally according to their political leaning. So, you know, like the Labour Party in Britain is together with the Democrats in Italy and the French Socialist Party. Whereas the Five Star Movement is in the same grouping as UKIP, the hard-right UK Independence Party. However, I don't think that it's as simple as the Five Star Movement is galvanized by racism or immigration or even really Euroscepticism. Grillo has said that he would like to hold a referendum on Italy's membership of the Eurozone, the common currency. But really the thing that holds the party together is just opposition to elites. So it's called, in Italy, it's called the caste. So there's this idea which is the same people are always in power in Italy, not just in the government, but like in public institutions, in trade unions, in the civil service. And, you know, this reflects a certain reality, which is that because patronage is so diffuse in Italy and because it's so hard for young people to get jobs, you have this kind of revolt of the people who are excluded against those who are seen as included. But it has certain definite kind of reactionary elements to it. I mean, it appeals to a kind of idea of common sense or going back to what the little guy thinks the kind of small businessman weighed down by taxes. But it's very eclectic. It has very opposite factions, and on kind of divisive issues of social policy, the MPs and senators decide in advance together how they're going to vote. And the idea is that this is meant to be democratic, because Grillo isn't even the leader of the party. He's just a kind of figurehead, but he's not even an MP. He's not allowed to stand for election because of a manslaughter conviction from the 80s. But when they decide so on the issues that have been in front of the Italian Parliament recently, like gay marriage, they all abstained because they couldn't agree. But what they do is they have different figures from the movement send opposite messages to the public. So, for example, some will say the proposal for gay civil unions didn't go far enough because it didn't allow gay people to marry or to adopt children, whereas others will say we're against civil unions because marriage is for a man and a woman. So what the movement succeeds in doing is presenting itself as kind of everything and nothing, allowing voters to project their own beliefs onto it, because it's a kind of empty vessel. Of course, the question is whether that kind of way of doing politics could survive a test of power. And kind of already with the five-star movement mayor of Rome, Virginia Raggi, we're already seeing its kind of coalition of support starting to become unstuck as she actually has to make governmental choices, kind of in terms of things like laying off public sector workers.
What is the class base of its popularity?
It's very strong basically among the non-unionized working class and among young people, and probably also, I think you could say, among kind of small businessmen, which of course is a huge section of the Italian economy. I think it has very little kind of real kind of ruling class or kind of upper middle class support. For example, when there was the mayoral election this spring in Rome, the very most central and bourgeois district, the historic centre, voted for the Democrats, the historic so-called Workers' Party, whereas all of the peripheral districts, all of the poorest, all of the kind of abandoned working class voted for the five-star movement. In a way, it's probably quite comparable to the base of support of a party like Syriza, but with the difference that whereas Syriza came to power after there'd already been quite intense social struggles, strike movements and so on, in Italy there's a real lack of kind of social mobilization. So it's quite atomized kind of revolt against authority and against the Democrats.
And what about the Northern League? Its very name would suggest that its geographical appeal is limited, but how important a player is it?
I think it's easy to overstate, because after the referendum, it was congratulated by Marine Le Pen, the leader of the French far-right, Front National, and also Nigel Farage from UKIP. So it's easy to kind of think that the Northern League is the leading actor in all this. Probably, though, I mean, it only has about 12 or 13% in the polls, which is similar to what it did in the early 2000s, before it entered government under Berlusconi. It's a hard right party, but it does succeed in winning working class support in kind of northern industrial areas that used to vote communist, but which are no longer industrial, sort of areas where factories have closed down, where there's unemployment. And there its kind of anti-immigrant message is probably is quite effective. Part of the dynamic of the Lega Nord, historically, it's actually called for the north of Italy to become an independent state. They've kind of backed away from that. And also, so the idea being that southerners are lazy, kind of not really white, not really Europeans. So, and that Rome, as the center of politics, is seen as a kind of den of corruption and incompetence and so on. But recently, it's actually set up another party called Us with Salvini. Salvini is the leader of the Lega Nord. So they just kind of create a southern party, which so the Lega Nord blames southerners, but then the southern affiliate in turn blames Albanians, Moroccans, and so on. I think its potential significance is that it could become a coalition partner for the five-star movement after the next elections, in which case it would probably succeed in dragging the five-star movement to the right. both because of its much politically stronger and more cohesive, and also because there's already elements of that within the Five Star Movement's own coalition of support.
It seems in many countries around the world we've seen this pattern of left parties moving to the center, becoming very aggressive agents of neoliberalism, the traditional right being rather vicious, and then the rise of these, quirky, comical, oddball parties with very vague politics. But what's really missing is anything like something recognizably left. You know, is that what's operating here?
Well, I'm afraid so. I mean, the left really has been in pretty long-term decline. And as I say, what was once a huge communist party, which even in 1991 still had over a million members and was the second party, has now become the Democrats. Those who tried to keep the party going, as I said, Rifondazione Comunista, entered government together with the centre-left, the Blairites, and basically destroyed themselves in the process. So the problem was is that in the name of fighting Berlusconi, they voted for whatever the Blairites wanted to do. But then when the financial crisis came, it was the Five Star Movement who looked like the anti-establishment force because, you know, they weren't in the corridors of power and had never been. And also there's other factors in Italian public life which limit the prospect of the left taking off again. The lack of trade union struggles, the fact that the main kind of force for opposition in society is young people whose prospects are so hopeless. That's 81% of under 35s voted no. Probably a similar proportion of Italian 30-year-olds live with their parents, which means, you know, or it reflects the fact that young people find it impossible to find work, and often after leaving school or university will go a decade and their only option is to emigrate or stay at home and be unemployed. I think in that sense, though, the Italian situation is different to the kind of electorate of Trump or Marine Le Pen or the Brexit or UKIP vote, in that it's not so, because while in those cases the working class element of their support tends to be older white men, either from declining sections of the middle class or non-unionized sections of the working class, in Italy it really is young people who are the driving force behind both the no vote and the Five Star Movement.
And we're just about out of time, but what happens next?
In terms of the actual process, I mean, I think that the president of Italy, Sergio Mattarella, is likely to appoint another prime minister from within Renzi's own party, or in any case, one of the independents in his government, possibly Pier Carlo Padoan, who's the finance minister. They'll push through some sort of electoral reform. It's possible we'll have elections next spring rather than May 2018, and I think also the European Union, or the European Central Bank rather, will ensure the stability of the Italian banks. As for the left, I mean, I think it had something of a recovery in terms of its public visibility during the election campaign after long years of defeat. In Naples, it's particularly interesting, movements going with the social centres and with the far-left mayor, Luigi Di Magistris. I also have a piece about that in Jacobin recently. And we saw the trade unions and a big section of the Democrat Party come out against its leadership. In terms of the selection of the new government, it's very unlikely that we'll see a swing to the left within the Democrat Party or its leadership, because it will be a matter of sort of stabilising the markets, the financial situation. Nonetheless, I do think that the movement for no, while the right and social and sort of Five Star Movement were stronger actors in the campaign, I think we did see something of the left raising its head again. So I think there are some prospects for it recovering and not just letting the Five Star Movement dominate the anti-establishment moves.
That was David Broder, a Rome-based researcher and writer who's been covering Italian politics for Jacobin magazine. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Some more Scarlatti performed by Kirkpatrick. This is a sonata in C, K357. Till next week. Bye.